Welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dell, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, and welcome to Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dale, NabTrade's Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. We're doing a little bit of a different one today. I have been recently presenting a topic at the ASX Investor Day. So the ASX Investor Day is held twice a year. It is now on Saturdays, which is awesome. There's 600 people in Sydney. So huge numbers of people who come along to learn as much as they possibly can about investing in the share market via the ASX. And the presentation I've been giving is called Hot Stocks, What Savvy Investors Are Buying. So giving this content to you as a listener, if you're unable to come to the event. Now we've made the presentation itself available also, so you can go to the NabTrade website. We'll have all of the links there for you to follow along with the presentation. It's a little bit visual, so it helps to have the presentation with you when I'm talking to some of the concepts and ideas that are represented visually as well as verbally. Another thing that might be useful for you, so there is one more event in Melbourne that will be on the 24th of November, Saturday the 24th of November. So if you'd like to attend, there may be some spaces available. I'm not sure. If you go to the ASX website or type in ASX Investor Day, you may still be lucky enough to get a ticket to go along. And there is a code if you'd like to get a 50% discount on that for NabTrade investors. If you are listening to this, you will note it's probably quite a long topic relative to some that we have done, and some of the podcasts do get terribly long. I have a tip for you. So if you are listening on an iPhone, when you look at your screen, when you are listening to the podcast, you'll have your little play button in the middle. On the bottom left-hand side, there is a 1x or 1x, which is actually indicative of the speed you're listening at. You can increase the speed of effectively the voices you're listening to or the recording to 1.5x or 2x or more if you'd like to. Generally, 2 is about as much as a human ear can accommodate. What that means is a 45-minute podcast is now going to be a 22.5-minute podcast. But the cool bit about it is there's a heap of research that says that we actually have better recall listening to things at greater than normal speed than normal speed. So if you want to speed up the time listening to stuff or get through it in a shorter period of time, and you want to improve your recall, it's something worth giving a go to. I believe Podbean also gives you this option. You might have to have a look at the app for that too. So anyway, cool tip, give it a go. So I'll get into the presentation. It is entitled Hot Stocks, What Savvy Investors Are Buying. Now, usual disclaimer, presentation is general in nature. Make sure you go and seek some advice if you need it. And NAB is not a registered tax agent. But the purpose of this presentation is to take you through something we've been talking about in this podcast for a really long time. And that is how to get adequate diversification into your portfolio. The first half of this presentation makes it really clear why I keep banging on about it and why I keep inviting guests on who offer alternatives to you in terms of how you do diversify your portfolio better. So we're going to talk about what retail investors really hold and look at a number of different data sources for that. So the SMSF data from the ATO, we're going to have a look at the ASX Investor Survey, have a look at Investment Trends, which is a commercial enterprise where they research effectively survey lots and lots of people about what they hold, and also some data from NabTrade investors. So what do our investors really, really hold? So what does that mean for their portfolio and for their performance? And then we're going to talk about where the smart money's going. So people who avoid some of the pitfalls, who are looking for major trends and themes in their portfolio, where they really want their money invested and where you really want your money invested, and then the easy ways to get access to this stuff without leaving the ASX, because we know many of our investors are very happy and very comfortable with the ASX, but diversifying further beyond that can be a little bit intimidating. So I'm on slide number 4 now, and this slide is and I'll talk it through, right? So you don't necessarily have to have them with you if you are listening on the train or at the gym or somewhere where it's a little bit difficult. But this slide has a chart showing the breakdown of assets held by the average online trader in Australia. Now, the reason we're using online traders is this is the research we have from Investment Trends. But also, it actually does correlate pretty highly to the average person. The average person who holds investments, they will have these assets. And it doesn't change a lot from year to year. This is 3 years worth of investments. If I go back 5 or 6 or 7 years, it will actually look pretty similar. What it shows is 43% in Australian equities. So 43% in Australian equities of the average portfolio, about 5% in international shares, about 5% in ETFs, and about 5% in managed funds. Investment properties make up about 17%. Now that's dropped a bit over the last couple of years, so 19% in 2016 and 2017. That is quite interesting given the very dramatic run-up in property prices over those years, but they've actually dropped a bit. Cash is about 20%, and then very small allocations to other types of products. Cryptocurrency was in for the first time. I think that one will have dropped away since it was added and probably less relevant now. But it gives you an idea. So 43% in Australian equities, 15% across international equities, ETFs and managed funds, and about 17% in investment properties and 20-ish in cash products. So that is roughly the portfolio of the average Australian. You could call it balanced, I guess. 43% is quite high as an allocation to Australian equities for a balanced portfolio, but then 20% is very high allocation to cash as well. We include term deposits in cash too. So another way of looking at how the average investor is invested or where they hold their money is to look at self-managed super funds. And the reason we look at self-managed super funds is they put in a return every year, which tells us what they hold in their fund. So great source of data, very accurate data, and the ATO gets a fund return for every single fund, all 600,000 of them in the country. So we know we've got great data, and they're very interesting to look at because they're sort of a complete universe of investments. People are investing across all asset classes to diversify this specific portfolio. This is on slide 5 if you are following along, and it shows nearly 30% in cash in self-managed super funds. Now there's some interesting anomalies here. One is that half of all self-managed super fund assets are in pension phase, so there is a need for cash and term deposits to the extent that you need liquid assets that are very secure. So you do need very liquid, very secure assets. Do you need 30% of your portfolio in them? That's a different question. When you compare that to what a professional super fund manager will hold, they will hold less than 10% in cash. In this particular example, which is from 2018, APRA statistics from regulated funds, it's about 7 to 8% in cash. So when you look at self-managed super funds, they hold 4 times as much cash and term deposits as the average professional manager. When we look at fixed income though, we see a completely different story. So this is government bonds, corporate bonds, sort of professional fixed income products. The average self-managed super fund has about 2% in these kinds of products, a very, very small proportion, whereas a professional manager will hold something like 15%. So there's a huge divergence in what professional and retail investors hold in that space. In fixed income, almost none if you're a retail investor, reasonably high allocation if you're a professional. Now, Australian equities closer to each other, regulated funds, so ordinary public offer funds, Australian super, any of the others, hold on average about 27% in Australian equities. Self-managed super funds hold over 30. Now, it's worth considering that when you add in hybrids and REITs and other types of listed security, that goes over 40%, which correlates pretty highly with what we see in investment trends. A bit less for professional fund managers. The one where we see the most dramatic divergence is in international shares. So self-managed super funds hold less than 1% of their total assets in international equities directly. Now, plenty of people make this point to me that directly is unusual, right? Most people don't hold international shares directly. They might hold them in ETFs. They might hold them in LICs. They might hold them in managed funds. And that is true. However, when you go back to the previous slide, that's maybe 10% of the portfolio. Whereas when you look at a professional manager, they hold more than 25% in international equities. So you're talking 2.5, 3, maybe 4 times as much in international equities held by professional fund managers rather than self-managed super funds. Self-managed super funds also have a lot more direct property. And then this range of other assets, which is sort of a little bit harder to quantify. So there's a big long slide on number 6 if you want to have a look at it, which sort of breaks down the portfolio of self-managed super funds a little bit more deeply. But all you need to know is that self-managed super funds, as a proxy for the average retail portfolio, have very, very little in international equities and a lot in cash, a lot in term deposits, and more in Australian equities than the average professional fund manager. So the question then becomes, does it matter, right? Does it really matter where you're holding your assets? If you can get the performance, nobody cares, right? If you're getting a great return on your portfolio or you're getting the right return, because it's important to understand that maybe what you're seeking is lower volatility or a high yield because you're in pension phase, sure. So the slide, or the picture on slide number 7 shows the relative performance of self-managed super funds versus professional fund managers, so professional super fund managers over the last 10 years. Go to 2016, because that's the best data we have from the ATO at the moment. What it shows is that self-managed super funds dramatically outperformed public offer funds, like professionally managed funds, in 2007, 2008, and 2009. So that's pretty impressive, right? Mums and dads outperforming the big guns in a really big way through very different markets. 2007 was a massive bull market, 2008, 2009, not so much. So you see this real divergence there in performance. The primary reason for that was that funds held a lot in cash and term deposits when markets turned really badly. So they hung on to much more of the performance that internationally overweight professional fund managers gave away. But then when you look at the subsequent 6 years, you see a really different outcome, which is that self-managed super funds have given away a lot of performance to professional fund managers because they've been underweight international equities, which have run really hard, and because they've been overweight cash, which has performed really badly because rates are so low. So over a 10-year period, if you did have a self-managed super fund in 2007, that's an important thing. And also recognizing these are averages, there are 600,000 funds, right? So everybody has different allocations, but this is the average. Then you could have given away a lot of performance over the last 6 years, but you did do very well for the first few years. If, however, you've done the average over the last 5 years, it's not been that much fun for you. We'll talk about the ASX Investor Survey as well. So this is slide number 8. And this is the ASX asking investors, and they ask thousands of investors, so the data is very good, how well they understand the concept of diversification. Now, they say 46% of investors in the survey said they were diversified, they claimed to be diversified, and yet they hold only 2.7 investment products. I'll say before we go any further that the sort of rule of thumb for diversification is that you must hold at least 20 different assets in a single asset class in order to be considered diversified. And the whole purpose of diversification is that you smooth out your risk profile. So you increase the likelihood that you're holding some of the winners, and you decrease the likelihood that you're holding only losers. And therefore, you've smoothed out your risk profile, but you also increase the chance of getting the upside if somebody's doing really well, just one or two stocks out of your portfolio. Now, I'm going to show you what that means in a minute, a really very live example of what that means. 2.7 investment products is 100% not diversified, right? There's no way that can be diversified. Now, there is good academic research that suggests once you get over 10 securities in any particular asset class, then you might get most of the benefits of diversification, and further diversifying might not improve your risk return profile dramatically. And once you get over hundreds of securities, or even over 50 or 60, depending, you know, if you're just in the ASX, for example, then you've probably given away all the benefits of diversification. You may as well just get an index fund, right? So you've got to get the number roughly right to get the benefits of diversification? I'm talking specifically about Australia now or just one market. If you go into international markets, different story because there's so many sectors and so many geographies, you need to have more than 10 or 20 securities in order to be adequately diversified. 2.7 is not going to cut it. 40% of investors say they don't have diversified portfolios, and they are correct because they have only 1.6 investment products. 15% don't know, so they're not sure. And 75% of share owners only hold Australian shares. So that's 3/4 of the population who were surveyed, but probably accurate based on the other information we've got, only hold Aussie equities. So we can see from all of this data, diversification is still really an issue for Australian investors. And as I said, there's a reason why we keep banging on about this. So I'm sorry if you're already very well diversified. You've done a great job. But it is worth hanging on to see whether or not the diversification you've attempted to factor into your portfolio is achieving what you want it to achieve. So in terms of a live example, if we go to slide 9, what I've put here is the top 10 holdings for all NAB trade investors. Now, these are fairly predictable, right? They look pretty close to the top 10 holdings on the ASX in general, but the proportion held by NAB trade investors is very high. Those 10 stocks added up account for over 50% of our entire book of Australian equities. Over 30% of them are just in financials. Now, it's a little bit different to the ASX in that over 11% is held in NAB, and that reflects the fact that a lot of NAB shareholders and customers hold NAB stocks, so you get a bit of a correlation there. 8% in CBA, nearly 6% in Westpac, 5.5% in BHP, and nearly 5% in ANZ. So of those top 5 stocks, 4 are banks. Only one is different, that's BHP. Then you've got Telstra, you've got CSL, you've got Wesfarmers, Woolworths and Macquarie. Now some of you are probably mentally tallying up which one of these you want to hold and which ones you won't. We've done the work for you. So if you go to slide number 10, this will show you the performance, the total performance of these 10 stocks over the last 5 years. Now this is about a month out of date now. It may have improved slightly since we pulled these numbers, but it won't have changed dramatically, right? It's worth recognizing. NAB, the total 5-year performance was less than 4%. And that is including your yield, including your dividend. Now, it doesn't account for the benefit of grossing up for franking credits, but unless you gross up for franking credits, there's a meaningful chance you would have been better off in cash, depending on the day you bought and the day you sold. CBA was 20%+. Westpac, though, around 7%. BHP, 20-ish%. ANZ, 7%. Again, so that is a 7% total return over 5 years. Not compounding, but total return. Telstra was down 16%+. CSL is the standout for you, right? So CSL and Macquarie are the two that you want to hold in this portfolio at roughly 200% each. So 200%, that's a spectacular performance over 5 years. Everyone would be very happy with that. Those guys have done really well. Wesfarmers has done well, but Woolworths has done really poorly, and you've actually got a negative return. So when I talk about diversification, it's really clear that you must diversify across sectors as well as across stocks. If you hold 10 stocks, but 5 of them are in the same sector, then you're going to get highly correlated returns. And if it's a sector that's done poorly over 5 years, you've done really poorly over 5 years. Now, if you didn't hold Macquarie or CSL, you've had a really rough 5 years. And the reason for that is that the sectors that you have been exposed to have had a rough 5 years. So thinking about diversification is really important. So one of the questions I get when I talk about diversification is, but what about ETFs and LICs? What about the products that are diversified that people do hold? Worth pointing out that they are not as significant as some of the headlines might lead you to believe, right? So ETFs account for around 4% of turnover on the ASX. They account for about 4% of holdings on NAB trade. And of the ETFs that our investors hold, more than 50% of those are invested only in the ASX. So slide number 11 shows you that there is a long tail of geographically diversified ETFs that our investors hold, but the vast majority of them are actually held just in Australia, which, as we know, is a tiny proportion of the global market. So generally, it is described as less than 2%, although I'll show you a little bit later where that 2% number comes from. LICs are pretty similar. So of the LIC market, it is actually dominated. When you look at the slide, that big dark ring around the circle is Australia. 244 million is invested in LICs just purely in the ASX. When you look at global, it's 191 million. So the whole of the world is only two-thirds of what is invested just in Australia. So I'm going to talk about home bias, because that is clearly what Australian investors are demonstrating. Home bias is where you basically have a really strong preference for investing in your own market, and you don't look abroad. Now, there are genuine benefits to this, and I think it's really important to recognise why people do it. It's not stupid. It makes a lot of sense. It just does have risks attached to it that are worth recognising. So the obvious benefits to home bias are that you have a clear understanding of the market that you're dealing with. You have personal experience of the companies that you are investing in. You know Woolworths much better than you know Tesco, for example, or Walmart. You know NAB much better than you know any of the banks in the UK or the US. You understand the local tax treatment, which is really important, and we all appreciate the value of franking and how much impact it has on investor portfolios. We also understand the local regulatory framework. So when something changes, the government announces new policy or new legislation, you can immediately understand what that's going to do to the stocks in your portfolio. Afterpay is a great example of this, where when there was an announcement made that there would be an inquiry into credit law to look at those companies that were providing services outside current credit law, payday lenders and all these sorts of things. And Afterpay was one of the ones being looked at because the services they provide are not currently dealt with by credit law. Australian investors immediately sold off Afterpay because they knew there's risk in that for the Afterpay stock. Now, the risk may play out or it may not, but Australian investors could respond to that automatically. Whereas if you see something like that in China, for example, or in the US, or in any other jurisdiction, it's much harder to understand the regulatory framework and the likely impact of any policy quickly enough to buy or sell stock based on that particular piece of information. The other thing is you've got much better quality access to insights and research and so on in Australia, because that's the way the market is supported. As if you were looking at international securities and so on, there are plenty of great insights and plenty of great research out there, but it's much harder to access. On the flip side, the risks are very significant. And any investor who has followed what's been happening with US markets over the last 5 years would know that they have given away a heap of performance because they have been sticking primarily to Australian-based companies. Now, the issue of sector concentration I'll show you in a minute, but the other thing is there are incredible tailwinds for other sectors that are just not well represented in Australia. We don't have an amazing pharmaceutical sector, for example. We don't have an amazing technology sector. Incredible homegrown tech stocks like Atlassian list in the US. So we don't have some of these incredibly fast-growing companies and sectors, and therefore you may be underexposed to growth opportunities and you may be overexposed to things that are facing headwinds such as financials. You've also got issues like trade and so on, and you've got to look at the Australian economy and go, we've had the longest period of economic expansion of any economy in history. At some point, that incredible golden run is going to come to an end, and maybe I want to ensure that I've got exposure to some other places so that I can take advantage of their golden era as well. Quick slide on number 13, which shows sector concentration in Australia. The ASX 300, over 60% of it is in two sectors, resources and banks. So that leaves less than 40% for every other sector. When you look at MSCI World, which I'll talk about in a little while, you will see that less than 30% is in banks and resources, and therefore 70%+ is exposed to all the other fun stuff that you might be interested in investing in. So a little question, we've talked about this actually in the podcast before, so if you're a regular listener, this one's not going to come as a big surprise to you. But when we talk about which share markets have actually delivered the best returns over the last 5 and 15 years, there's a couple of names in there you may not be familiar with. If we look at 5 years, then the absolute standout is the NASDAQ. If you had invested $100, so 100 Australian dollars, and everything is returned to Australian dollars, in this particular analysis, in the NASDAQ 5 years ago, you would now have $259. Had you invested the same $100 in the All Ords, you would have got $136. So nearly double in the NASDAQ to what you've received from the All Ords. But the ones that people tend not to consider are China and India, because they're just thinking about the S&P 500. Now, the S&P 500 has done really well, $227, but India has returned $210 over the same period, so only slightly less. And you will note, if you are looking at the chart, which is slide 15, or if you want to pull up these charts yourself, because you can always find them, that it's only the last 6 months that has actually had the S&P 500 outperforming the Indian stock exchange. And prior to that, had we pulled the data on the 1st of January this year, the S&P 500 would have actually underperformed the Indian stock market over the last 5 years. If we look at 15 years, so 15 years to October this year, you would have, from your $100 invested in Aussie dollar terms, $341 if you invested in the All Ords. You would have almost the same amount if you'd been in the S&P 500, so $358, only $6 or $7 difference there. The NASDAQ, $437. The Chinese market, $447, and India, you would have $466. So in this example, 15 years to October 2018, all returned to Aussie dollars, you would have outperformed had you held your money in India over Australia or the S&P 500, which shocks a lot of people, and materially outperformed by over $100. So quite significant. The only reason I point this out, by the way, is that when we talk about the themes that our investors are looking for, it's worth thinking about what jurisdictions are playing those themes really effectively. So I'm going to go into that in a minute. We'll talk about what the smart money is buying now. So I've probably overplayed the point that everyone is woefully under-diversified if they're traditionally invested in Australia. And it's very typical. It's typical of every country in the world. Australia, however, has the second highest level of home bias of any other country. US is the only one that is stronger, has more home bias in terms of people investing in their own stock exchange. And they've probably got a better justification for it, because most of their, or many of their mega caps actually have extraordinary global exposure in a way that many Australian companies don't. So what do you buy? If you want to diversify your portfolio and you appreciate that holding those top 10 stocks as half your portfolio is not potentially giving you the return that you're after. So what we see from our investors is that they are buying ETFs, they're buying LICs, and they're buying ETMFs or active ETFs, and also MFund, which I don't have on the slide, specifically looking for diversified products that they can buy at home, which makes life really easy. Now, to understand the different structures, the ETF, the LIC, the active ETF, and so on, if you're not familiar with them, there is a podcast with Charmaine Breeden from the ASX from just a couple of weeks ago. Go back and have a listen to that one. Charmaine's done a sensational job of explaining how these different structures work, what the pros and cons are of the different types. So if you're worried about what type of structure or what type of instrument to use, she did a brilliant job with that. And you can find it where you find the rest of the podcast. So have a bit of a listen if you're interested in the instrument itself. What we're going to have a look at is the breakdown of what investors are buying if they do diversify beyond Australia. So if we look at those 4% of ETFs that investors are buying, and we strip out the 2% or more that are in Australia, let's have a look at everything else. And you will see far and away the US is where people are going. It is over 50%. It was actually over 100% higher than the next, which is global, then Global X Australia. It's not until you get to the fourth largest, which is Global UX, Global X US, And that is numerically kind of a rounding error in terms of percentage terms. So really small amounts going to anything that's not dominated by the US. We'll talk about why that is. Now, I've put up for anyone who's interested what the MSCI world actually is, because it's worth understanding what an index is. And we talked about it in a lot of earlier podcasts, but what an index is and what is held in it before you go, I'm going to diversify and I'm just going to buy the world index. So Morningstar produces the MSCI World and also the ACWI, which is the All Country World Index. Now they're slightly different. The ACWI includes emerging markets. It's less than 12%, but it is worth noting if you are looking for emerging markets, and that's where we're talking about some of the indices I mentioned earlier, you do need to buy the ACWI. And you are only getting 12% of your portfolio exposed in that way. Asia ex Japan is only 1.55% in that index. The US, however, is 54%. So over half of your money is invested in the US. So if you already hold an S&P 500 or a NASDAQ, for example, or you'd like to explicitly carve that out, if you then go and buy the MSCI, particularly if you buy the MSCI world, which doesn't include emerging markets, and therefore the US is actually closer to 60%, then you might be duplicating some of your portfolio. So the point of this is the world index is heavily dominated by the US, and it very much underrepresents some of the emerging markets, even though the populations of those countries are enormous and their economies are massive. So there's a big difference between the size of a country's economy and the size of its market as they are represented in the global indices. So if you're looking for specific things, just make sure you don't go and buy an ETF or a managed fund with a headline that doesn't necessarily represent what you're trying to buy. Just make sure you do that extra tiny bit of research to understand which geographies it's invested in. So talking on slide 20 about what our investors are trying to buy. So when we look at what our savvy investors are looking for when they understand that they want to be diversified beyond financials and resources and the other sort of darlings in the Australian market, they're looking for two major themes. And these two major themes are talked about a lot on this podcast. One is disruption. So technology disruption, incredibly popular theme around the world. There's a reason why the NASDAQ has been the best performing market. Tech giants in the US, FANG, Margo we talked about with Mary Manning from Elliston Capital. Also the Asian tech giants. So many of our investors, and you'll see this shortly, are looking to Asia for where the technology opportunities are going to come from. And the two acronyms you would also have picked up from Mary's podcast were STAT, which is Samsung, Tencent, Alibaba, and Taiwan Semiconductors, and BAT, which is Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent. So this disruption theme is really, really strong through what our investors are looking for. The other one is demographic trends. So investors looking to buy the incredible powerhouse growth economies of the world. Now, the US economy is growing really strongly, that is for sure. It's also a fairly mature economy. So looking for that incredible rise of the middle class, looking for increasing wealth of the population that may previously have been in poverty, in fact, in many cases. Looking for that real rise in wealth, very rapid development, and also watching that assisted by technology, which is quite interesting. So these two trends are somewhat correlated. So we see a lot of interest, particularly in China and India, as the two largest populations in the world, but also two of the most rapidly developing populations in the world in terms of their wealth. Now, NabTrade investors, as you know, can invest offshore directly. They can invest in the US, the UK, Germany, and Hong Kong. So I'm going to talk through a bit through what our investors are actually buying when they go offshore. On slide 22, you will see a handful of brands effectively. A lot of our investors are buying brands, and the standout from this slide, if you know the names on it, is that 9 out of 10 of them are in the technology sector. So Tencent, Alibaba, Microsoft, Amazon, Nvidia, Netflix, Baidu, Facebook, and Advanced Micro Devices, all in the tech sector, focusing on different things, absolutely, but all in the tech sector. The one standout that is not in the tech sector is Berkshire Hathaway. So that has always been popular ever since we made direct investing in the US available to our investors. Berkshire Hathaway has been in that top 10 list. You will note that Apple is not on there. So that surprises many people. My suspicion is that it is still a very substantial holding rather than a buying. Many of our investors have actually been buying that over the last couple of years and they're holding it now rather than buying more. Whereas stocks like Tencent have been sold off really heavily this year, you know, down over 30%. So investors are buying it now as an opportunity to see some growth in the future, but also the lovely thing is not buying it at the peak. So Tencent, Alibaba, and Baidu are Chinese-based technology stocks. Amazon, Netflix, Nvidia, Facebook, Microsoft, and Advanced Micro Devices, obviously US-based. So investors clearly trying to diversify geographically, right? That is 3 out of 10 that are not based in the US. When we have a look at Global Titans by market cap, you will see effectively what are valued as the most, or what are the top 10 most valuable stocks in the world, right? Apple is number one. And when you look at the MSCI, it is 2.8% of the MSCI now, one company, which is extraordinary. Followed by Microsoft, Amazon, Johnson & Johnson, so more of a traditional company. JP Morgan Chase, also more traditional. Facebook, ExxonMobil, Alphabet, and Bank of America. So when you compare that to what our savvy investors or our smart investors have been buying, it is less technology focused. Apple, Microsoft, and Amazon all working in the technology space, also Facebook and Alphabet. But Bank of America, JP Morgan, Johnson & Johnson, much more traditional. And something like ExxonMobil in a different kind of field entirely. So different focuses. Our investors very, very heavily focused on technology and very, very focused on high growth companies in that technology field, particularly with that additional demographic slant of moving into China, moving into Asia with rising wealth, but also very sophisticated technology companies. The thing about the Global Titans by market cap is all of the top 10 are based in the US. Now, our investors are not just buying in the US, they're looking for something different. I've also pulled the Global Titans by revenue. So the top 10 companies in the world by revenue are very, very different to the top 10 companies in the world by market capitalization. So what people are willing to pay for versus what actually generates the income is a little bit different. This is slide 24 if you're following along. Currently, the global top 10 companies by revenue, this is according to Fortune magazine this year, are Walmart at number one, State Grid of China is number two, Sinopec is number three, China Natural Petroleum is number four. So of the top four companies in the world by revenue, three are Chinese. Number five is Royal Dutch Shell, which is based in the Netherlands. Now, I love this because the Dutch are one country where home bias is not a thing. They don't have home bias. They invest 99% of their portfolio offshore, not in domestic companies. And yet they have a domestic company in the top five. So that is quite fascinating. They do have some mega caps themselves, but they're very internationally focused with their money. Toyota is number six, Japanese. Volkswagen, number seven, German. BP from the UK at number eight, ExxonMobil. So you will notice ExxonMobil is the first one that we have seen from the previous slide. The market cap, that is US-based, at number nine, and Berkshire Hathaway at number 10. So the only one in the global titans by revenue that NabTrade investors are buying. And you can see from this that the ones that are generating massive revenue are not necessarily the companies that you are going to invest in if you're looking for growth. Most of our investors, when they go offshore, are looking for growth, and they are also looking to diversify away from the sectors that they're already well invested in. Berkshire Hathaway is the obvious example, where it's effectively a listed investment company. You get a bit of everything you need to diversify. One slide I did want to pull up, number 25, we do talk to investors a bit about. And I hear this a lot from people, is that they are very interested in playing the demographic story. So they do want to get exposure to the rise of China, but they're not going to leave the ASX, and they're also not going to buy diversified products. They are going to buy Australian companies that are exposed to that growth. And we've seen that trade over the last 3 or 4 years come through really strongly. The obvious examples I've put down on this slide are A2 Milk, Bellamy's, Blackmores, and Treasury Wine Estates. The thing I would draw your attention to, two things there. One is what proportion of their sales is actually coming from Asia. And in each case, it is less than 30%. So Treasury Wine Estates, about 22% comes from China. Great stories in the paper recently about how much they expect to get and how quickly that is growing. So it is growing really, really well, but it's worth noting it's still largely a domestic company. Most of their revenue comes from onshore. Also, their P's are very, very high when you compare them to some of the stocks that our investors are buying. So A2 Milk, 29 times, 25 times for Blackmores, 26 times for Treasury Wine Estates. You're talking about companies on PEs of more than 20 times, and yet the Hang Seng at the moment, if you were looking to buy a Tencent, for example, you are looking at an entire market trading on less than 9 times. That's pretty astonishing. Sorry, I should time state this podcast because these things do move around and you'll think that I'm crazy. But in the middle of November 2018, Hang Seng trading on less than 10 times. So let's have a look at how you can play these themes, right? Most investors are convinced of the desire to trade these opportunities, the demographic trend and the technology trend. They know that buying only domestic companies is not going to do it. It's how you do it that matters, right? So, exchange-traded funds and professionally managed portfolios are the two most obvious ways you can do this. Alternatively, you can, like many of our smart investors, buy the stocks directly. So you do have that option. As I said, you can invest in US, UK, Germany, and Hong Kong via NabTrade. Just worth noting that they are stocks bought directly on those exchanges, right? So once you get your head around that, no problem whatsoever. You are stock picking, and that's quite fun for a lot of our investors. They love it. But if you're not ready to do stock picking in other geographies, then you have other options available to you, and you can stay on the ASX, which is a nice, safe option for heaps of investors. Things to keep in mind. Sectors. Are you investing in the sectors where you currently don't have exposure? Because that is the point of diversification. Are you getting stuff you don't already have? And in terms of geography, are you getting access to markets you don't currently have exposure to? The critical point being, if you're trying to play the demographic trend, are you ensuring that you get access to those markets? So what NabTrade investors were buying on the ASX in terms of diversified portfolios in October? I've taken ETFs and pulled those down. I've even listed for you the ETF providers. Now, this is just October and it moves around a lot every month, right? So if I pull this again for you in November, you may well see a completely different set of names. Slide 27. So the number one ETF bought on the ASX on NabTrade in October was actually Australian Equities Strong Bear Hedge Fund. This was investors who believed the ASX was going to fall and they bought a fund that was going to give them upside in that event. Now, they also bought a strong US dollar hedge fund, the S&P 500, a US equities strong bear, and it was currency hedged. So in this situation, investors felt that the market in the US was going to fall and they bought a product to give them a return in that scenario. Got a lot of questions giving this presentation in Sydney about currency hedging. It's really worth knowing that plenty of these products will give you the opportunity to buy both a hedged and an unhedged option. That is really valuable. I'm also in a podcast in the next couple of weeks with Magellan going to talk about the value of hedging, why you would do it, why you would choose a hedged option over an unhedged option, costs and all those sorts of things. So hang out for that one if you'd like to know a bit more about it. US total market, a geared Australian equity fund, the MSCI International, hedged, MSCI International unhedged. So currency taken out of the equation, currency left in the equation, Global 100 and the NASDAQ 100 was the 10th most bought ETF on the ASX via NabTrade in October. Now, One thing I am always keen to show people is that if you wish to go and buy the world's most extraordinary universe of listed diversified products, you go to the US, right? Incredible what you can buy. Here is what our investors are buying when they go to the US in terms of diversified product. The Vanguard 500, which is effectively the S&P 500, an ultra short 20-year treasury, which is effectively taking a bet on a downturn in US treasuries. That's a strong position. The Israeli market, the FTSE All World X US, various other products. So an ultra silver fund, a biotechnology fund, a total stock market fund, robotics and artificial intelligence, that's been very popular. Small cap bear fund, information technology fund, S&P 500 growth, developed markets, lithium and battery technology, semiconductors, and again, robotics and automation. So what I have done, if you are looking at the slides, is at slide 28, I have put a star next to each of these that you can buy on the ASX. You don't have to go to the US to buy half, literally half, of these products. Of the 20 that are listed there, 10 have an equivalent in Australia on the ASX that you can just buy. Now, it's worth noting, if you do want to buy in the US, you can do it via NabTrade. The brokerage costs are no different. They're exactly the same. So that's absolutely fine. You can do it. But if you prefer to keep everything on the ASX, and many people would, you can do it for literally half of the things that I just listed, including the robotics and automation, the robotics and artificial intelligence, the biotechnology, the total stock market, the S&P 500, and the lithium battery technology. So some of the things that people are trying to buy, they're all here. Also worth noting some of the fund managers that people are buying. So many, many LICs have come to market. Some of them are really fabulous in terms of giving you exposure to something that you would not have otherwise had exposure to. They are professionally managed. Some of the markets I've been talking about, I personally prefer to have a professional fund manager looking at them. I think indexing is brilliant in a highly liquid, well-researched market like the US, for example. However, other markets which may be less well researched and have less coverage, you might get real value from having a professional stock picker looking after your portfolio for you. And that's how I choose to do it. So I have some ETFs and some LICs in markets where I am either not confident or don't have the time to pick my own stocks. So I've got a number of them listed there for you. There are others out there. This is by no means a recommendation for any of these. Some of them you've heard on this podcast, some of them you will hear on this podcast in the future, but some to look into if you're interested in looking at the LIC world as well as ETFs. I will say that I get the question every time I give a presentation of this nature. When we launched our global product a few years ago, when I was doing some of the media around it, a lot of commentators said to me, "Yes, but Gemma, you know, wouldn't it have been nice if you brought this to us in 2010 rather than in 2015? And the point was that the Australian dollar had been very, very high, nearly touching $1.10 US. And the stock market had rallied really highly, really hard at the same time that the dollar had dropped, and therefore people would have gotten a spectacular return from that point in time. And when people were asking me that question, clearly the undercurrent was, well, all the good times have been had, right? Good times have been had, and investing globally right now is not the smartest idea anyone ever had. Well, that was 3 years ago. And I think we all know that had you invested offshore 3 years ago, there was still plenty of upside left in the NASDAQ in particular and plenty of the other stock markets around the world. So you would have done just fine. Also, the dollar continued to fall away. And so you would have received some bump from the currency as well if you were not hedged. Slide 30. If you are looking at the slides, the purpose of this one is simply to show you that if you are looking at the NASDAQ, the S&P 500, or the Shanghai Stock Exchange, the only thing I can tell you is if you choose to buy now, you're not buying at the top. That's it. That's all I can tell you. I can't promise you that it doesn't have further to fall after a rough few months or a rough year in some cases, looking at the Shanghai. And I can't promise you it's definitely going to go up in the near term. But I can tell you, you're not buying at the peak. So you're buying at a bit of a discount from the highs. And long term, theoretically, all of these stock markets are going to deliver a strong return for you for the simple reason that you are investing in companies that are doing great things in the world. So can't promise you that you are definitely going to get the return you want in the short term, but good news is at least you're not buying at the peak. So a few other things that people are buying. Worth noting that many of our investors will also use these sorts of products for currency. So taking currency positions, you can buy a US dollar ETF if you wish. And I did a previous podcast with Chris Walesby from ETF Securities where he talked about those. So that was ETFs 101, I think back in January of 2018, if you'd like to go back and find that one. Commodities also, if you would like to take a position on commodities, there are products that give you that option. And shorts and bears, if you want to be brave and take a financial position that will pay off if the market is going the other way to your long position, then there are options out there for you. Obviously, do your research before you get into it if this is new for you, but plenty of exciting options out there. And we see a lot of our smart, sort of more active investors looking at these kinds of products at the moment. Volatility coming back into the market, lots of things happening, plenty of opportunities for investors to take a position with their money and get some exciting returns. So finally, just some things to consider. So diversification does matter, right? All of the evidence from all of the research over decades from academics and those in industry says that asset allocation has a much more significant impact on your performance than stock selection. If you choose the wrong market, you're going to hurt a lot more badly than if you just choose the wrong stock, unless you only hold one stock. So get your asset allocation right. And when I say get it right, I mean ensure you are adequately diversified for the risk profile that you currently have. So get your diversification right, get your asset allocation right, and then have a look at ensuring you're diversified adequately across the number of stocks and securities you hold. You need to look at the instrument structure. So we've talked about that, as I said, in previous podcasts. Some really good info out there if you would like to look into that. So plenty of awesome instruments now that you can use to get diversification. Just make sure you understand them before you buy them. Have a look at your fees and costs, particularly if you are indexing. If you are indexing, you absolutely will not outperform the market. That's the point of indexing. It's just giving you the market return. Therefore, pay as little as you can for that, ensuring obviously that you've gone to a quality and trustworthy provider. So make sure that you're not paying too much. And finally, understand your indices. I've talked about this a lot in a lot of our podcasts, but it is worth understanding where the sector concentration and the biases sit in the indices that you are invested in. If you can find it, make sure that you diversify away from those risks to ensure that your portfolio adequately reflects what you want to be exposed to. Now, at this point in the presentation, I generally take questions. It's a podcast, so unfortunately you can't ask me any this time. But if you do have any questions, there's anything you would like me to answer relating to this podcast or anything you'd like me to cover in the future, please just email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.